As the weather warms and Illinois begins another week under stay-at-home orders, defiance is beginning to rise. Meanwhile, major outbreaks continue at nursing homes and large manufacturing facilities. We'll talk to reporters around the state for the latest on COVID-19. Plus, we'll talk to an expert on the Illinois Constitution about legal challenges to the governor's stay-at-home orders.
The statement, it violates my civil rights because I want to leave my house, it just doesn't work.
And a new show from FX puts Phyllis Schlafly and Illinois' political history at its center. We'll talk more about what's fact and what's fiction in the series. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Monday morning, Illinois over the weekend reported another 5,400 confirmed cases of COVID-19, plus 168 more deaths. That brings the state total to more than 61,000 test-confirmed cases and 2,618 lives lost. Numbers, numbers, numbers. Every morning, we update those numbers at the beginning of our show, and I don't know about you, but for me, the bigger they've gotten, the more abstract they seem. So before we get to the rest of the show today, I want to share with you a way of thinking about the disease I found helpful. It landed in my inbox last week in Bloomberg's daily coronavirus email. The short piece by John Tazi is called Overcoming Abstraction, and it begins, quote, "Imagine that a plane crashed in early March, then another weeks later. Soon, several drop from the sky every day. People shun non-essential air travel, which limits the toll, but 2 months into the catastrophe, more than 1,000 still die daily, a jet crashing every few hours. How quickly would we rush back to the sky?" Unquote. Tazi acknowledges his analogy as imperfect. It's not just air travel that's been affected by COVID-19, but huge swaths of our economy. Nevertheless, imagine a standard domestic flight, say a 737, with 150 Illinoisans on board. One plane crashes, then another, and another, and another, and another, and by today, 17 full passenger planes would have had to crash in Illinois in the last month or so to kill the same number of our fellow citizens as the coronavirus. Later on today's program, we'll talk to an expert on the Illinois Constitution about legal challenges to the governor's stay-at-home orders, and we'll hear the perspective of a Southern Illinois woman who's been struggling since her barbershop, like so many other businesses, has been closed. Then a look at what's fact and what's fiction in Mrs. America, a new TV series from FX. It's about Phyllis Schlafly, who 4 decades ago helped defeat the National Equal Rights Amendment in the Illinois General Assembly. But first, it's Monday, and that means it's time for our reporter roundtable on the latest with COVID-19 in Illinois. Joining me to talk about that are Molly Parker, a reporter for the Southern Illinoisan, Allison Petty, regional editor with the Herald and Review paper in Decatur, and Rebecca Anzel, who covers the state government for Capital News Illinois, a wire service run by the State Press Foundation. Molly, Allison, Rebecca, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Molly, I'm going to begin with you. Over the weekend, you reported on a large outbreak at Gilster Mary Lee Corporation. First, what is Gilster Mary Lee Corporation and what's going on there?
Gilster Mary Lee is a food manufacturer. They make a lot of different types of products for store brands, like when you're in Kroger and you see the store brand, that's their wheelhouse. And they make everything from soup mixes to mac and cheese, all kinds of pasta, baking mixes for bread coating and, you know, chicken coating and things like that. Just a ton of products. They employ nearly 4,000 people across a handful of states, the most of them in Randolph County, which sits, you know, halfway between, say, Carbondale and St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And they've had a pretty large outbreak. They've had a number of things going on there. It started in the administrative office in early April, where the cases were identified, sadly leading to the untimely death of their president and CEO, had been at the company for just decades, Don Welge. A number of people affected, including his sons, and other office staff, many of which have recovered. But then there, you know, later was an outbreak in various plants that have had to shut down and take measures to try to control that now.
And just to be clear, I mean, I think a lot of people, when we've been talking about coronavirus in Illinois, people think mostly in the Chicago region, maybe the Metro East part of St. Louis, a handful of big downstate cities. But this is happening in remote areas, too, or relatively, you know, remote areas.
That's right. Randolph County is, you know, a pretty small community county of people, you know, just a handful of small towns. People probably know of Chester, home of Popeye. Stillville, that's where the plants are located. Gilster is headquartered in Chester, and they have two plants there, and then they have two plants in Stillville. And last I checked, Randolph County, you know, because of its low population and this surge of numbers related to Gilster Mary Lee, had one of the highest per capita rates of COVID infection. So it's definitely hitting our area here and lots of concern here, because this is also Randolph County, also the home of Menard Correctional Center, one of the state's largest IDOC facilities, as well as Chester Mental Health.
Yeah, two big state correctional. Well, I guess one's a correctional facility, the other's a mental health facility, as you said. Are you seeing outbreaks, any other major outbreaks in Southern Illinois, Molly, that you've been tracking?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them seem to be clustered around places like the employment center here, or like in the rest of the state, nursing homes. And I know we're going to be talking about that, but we've certainly had a couple of nursing homes, one in Carbondale, one in Mount Vernon, that have been, you know, hit pretty hard. And of course, it's hard to know, you know, the degree to whether this is happening elsewhere, because I think once they, you know, identify it, say at Gilster Mary Lee, there were cases popping up, and now they're doing not necessarily mass testing, as in everyone being tested, but they've stationed hospital workers there. And if anyone is symptomatic, they're testing them. So of course you're going to see more numbers, you know, when you do that. And so it's hard to know exactly where else it might be happening that we just don't know of yet.
Mm-hmm. All right, Allison Petty with the Decatur Herald and Review. I want to bring you into the conversation. As Molly just said, you see a lot of outbreaks at nursing homes and other facilities for senior citizens and people with disabilities. In Decatur, that includes Fair Havens. Can you tell us, remind us what happened at Fair Havens in Decatur?
Yes. So there have been at least 75 cases associated with Fair Havens between the staff and the residents. That's the number as of late last week. The staff at the facility say they don't know how it came in. The administration says it was first detected in a resident who had left for dialysis treatment and then was taken to the hospital from the dialysis center. So the facility says that it took every precaution to prevent the spread of this, although there are some families who are disputing that on social media. In any case, they've had 11 residents diagnosed with COVID-19 who have died. Some of them have died at hospitals. Some have died at the facility. It was April 7th when the health department here first confirmed that there had been cases there. And on April 20th, the Illinois Department of Public Health brought them 300 test kits. That's when the number really spiked. It went from 38 to 71 cases in one day.
Wow. I guess that just goes to the idea that just because the reported number of cases might be low, there are probably cases that are just not known until we can actually test for them. So, Allison, I understand you recently visited Fair Havens. What did you see? What was it like inside?
Yes, so I was invited by the facilities administration because they were primarily interested in having someone talk with their staff about what they were experiencing and kind of tell their story. But I did get a tour, and I went in on April 24th. I spoke with several of the staff members, nurses, and the CNA. And I also put on all the PPE and toured one of the units where the COVID positive patients were. I didn't go in any rooms with them, but I did see some empty resident rooms. And so I could see what the conditions were like, and I can see how easily it would spread in a, you know, a highly infectious disease in close quarters, because some of the rooms, you know, you have a roommate and then you and your roommate are sharing a bathroom with somebody else and their roommate. So you could see how something like that could spread, especially if you were asymptomatic and didn't know you had it. The staff members that I spoke with expressed that they were just heartsick about what was happening to the residents that they have been talking to every day and taking care of. And then they were also dealing with a lot of hate on social media from people calling them killers and saying that they caused the spread of this through, you know, neglectful treatment. And then a few of the staff members that I spoke with were also isolating themselves from their own families. So they were experiencing a lot of stress, a lot of emotion about that. Other than those things, you know, the PPE and the people being kind of closed off from the common areas, it seemed like a normal nursing home in that, you know, it was quiet, and they had put up like Hawaii decorations and things to try to make it a little more cheerful. But, you know, it was definitely a little bit more somber than you would normally expect.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. We're having our Monday Reporter Roundtable with the latest on COVID-19 across Illinois. We've just been speaking with Allison Petty, who's an editor at the Decatur Herald and Review paper. We've also been talking to Molly Parker, a reporter with the Southern Illinoisan. And now I want to bring Rebecca Anzell from Capital News Illinois into the conversation, Statehouse reporter. And Rebecca, there have been a number of legal filings in the last week or so. As a small number of people begin to resist the governor's stay-at-home orders. And let's start with the cases brought by the state representatives. What are those cases about?
So the first case was filed by Representative Darren Bailey. He's a Republican from Zena. His case was heard in Clay County, so down south. He was seeking to, just for himself, to be lifted from the governor's stay-at-home order. He said that the governor had exceeded his authority by issuing successive 30-day disaster proclamations. You know, a judge agreed with him and granted him a what's called a temporary restraining order. So he did get that relief. On Friday, he gave that up, though. His attorney had said that they have new documents, which Thomas DeVore had sort of characterized as a game changer. Those ended up being basically documents that showed the state was tasking the Illinois Department of Public Health and local health departments with enforcing the state home order. And so DeVore and, you know, Bailey by proxy is arguing that if the Illinois Department of Public Health is to enforce state home orders, they should follow the procedures outlined in the statute that created that department, which says an Illinois resident cannot be quarantined or isolated without either consenting to that or without a judge granting a court order. And that hasn't really happened. Representative John Cabello, who's a Republican, he's up north. His case is filed in Winnebago County. His suit applies to the entire state's residents and sort of encompasses that argument that I was just referencing, that the state overstepped their authority and the Department of Public Health is the one that should be enforcing quarantine and isolations. One key thing to note is that Governor Pritzker's executive orders don't say quarantine or isolation. They say stay at home. So it'll be interesting to see what a judge rules.
Yeah. And a little bit later, I'm going to be talking to one of, I think, our two favorite constitutional law experts, Anne Lucene, about her view of this. Molly, I wonder, are you beginning to see some of that defiance at the local level in Southern Illinois? Mayors, state's attorneys, people like that who say that they're not going to be enforcing the governor's orders?
Certainly. And I think there's maybe some nuance in what they're saying or trying to say, and maybe even some disagreements on who has the authority to even, you know, make these enforcement orders. But we've definitely seen growing, impatience with the governor's extended stay at home orders in Southern Illinois, where, you know, and the reality is, while we have some high per capita numbers in some of our counties, we don't have overwhelmed hospitals. I think that's generally fair to say. We've had a lot of hospital staff furloughed and people concerned about putting off, you know, elective surgeries. They say elective, but to some people, they're not maybe that elective. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's a lot of pushback and questions being asked. I mean, I could think of people who've made statements, the Johnson County Sheriff, the Jefferson County Sheriff, Perry County, you know, Energy, Harrisburg, Marion. They've all weighed in on this, but I think Rebecca was talking about this, you know, who has the authority, you know, I have never heard the governor talk about asking police departments to go around necessarily arresting people. My understanding is that authority lies with health departments. And that's been interesting to watch. You know, health departments are trying to respond when there are these congregated outbreaks like at Gilster Mary Lee, but, you know, they feel like they're lacking guidance. When is the right time to, you know, take action if it's necessary to tell a business, you know, in that case, an essential business, but if someone does open up, You know, I think there's going to be a patchwork of county response, but I definitely think in Southern Illinois, you're seeing the political divisions that were already there under the surface are certainly on display in this crisis as it moves forward.
Mm-hmm. And only a couple minutes left in our conversation, but Allison, are you seeing in the Decatur area any sort of rising frustration or defiance with the stay-at-home orders?
Yes, a little bit. So our city council had been set to vote tonight on adding the mask requirements to city code, which would have allowed police to have some teeth and be able to write tickets if people weren't complying. There was a big public outcry, and the mayor pulled it off the agenda after finding that there were then not enough council votes to pass it.
Hmm. And Rebecca, I guess last question to you, if you can talk a little bit about, there was a church lawsuit, and apparently a judge denied their request, but they ended up meeting over the weekend anyway, right?
Yeah, there's a church about 40 miles or so west of Rockford, the Beloved Church in Lena. They had filed just, you know, a suit saying that their First Amendment rights were being breached, and a judge did not agree with them. They did meet, though. About 60 to 80 people were there at services yesterday. And the church had said in the statement they issued hand sanitizer masks and such.
All right. Well, I'm sure we will continue to follow these developments as people continue trying to live or try not to live under the stay-at-home order. That's Rebecca Anzell, who covers state government for Capital News Illinois. We also spoke with Allison Petty, regional editor with the Decatur Herald and Review newspaper, and Molly Parker, reporter for the Southern Illinoisan. Thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Coming up, a number of conversations about the governor's stay-at-home order. We're going to be talking to an expert on the Illinois Constitution, a business owner in Southern Illinois, as well as a health department in Southern Illinois. Different perspectives on whether it's time to begin reopening Illinois' economy. That's coming up after the break. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we mentioned just a moment ago in our previous segment, there have been a handful of legal challenges to Governor Pritzker's stay-at-home orders in recent weeks. An Illinois judge granted an exception to the stay-at-home order to one Illinois lawmaker, Representative Darren Bailey. Another filed a broader challenge, and a church is suing as well. For a perspective on these cases and what Illinois' governor can and cannot do, this morning I called up one of the most knowledgeable people I know on the Illinois Constitution. Ann Lucene is a professor at the University of Illinois Chicago's John Marshall Law School. She was also once the parliamentarian of the Illinois House, and even more on point, she was on staff at Illinois' most recent constitutional convention back in 1970. Professor Ann Lucene, welcome to the 21st.
My pleasure.
So, I want to begin by asking about State Representative Darren Bailey filed a lawsuit against Governor Pritzker's stay-at-home order, saying it violated his civil rights. A judge ruled in his favor, but that decision only applied to him, so the stay-at-home order is still in place. But now at least one other person, another Republican state representative, John Cabello, has sued, seeking to block the order for the whole state. I wonder, what do you think of their legal arguments?
They're not very good, but I noticed that Representative Bailey has asked that the order in his favor be vacated so he can present new evidence, which he says he's going to present, which was unknown before. I have no idea what he's talking about. What new evidence? But we are on the merits. I don't think they have much of an argument. Can you say that the order should be changed on occasion and maybe not for everywhere in the state? Yes, I think we can talk about that. But the statement, it violates my civil rights because I want to leave my house, it just doesn't work.
Why does the governor have the power to order people to stay at home? What in Illinois gives him?
He has supreme executive power under the Illinois Constitution. And although he cannot be a tyrant, I mean, these statements, he's a tyrant, that's ridiculous. There is a national emergency. The President of the United States has declared an absolute national emergency that implicates national security. And the point is that he also has an Illinois Emergency Powers Act, which allows him to do, so far as I can gather, everything that he has done so far.
And we don't know yet if the governor will extend the stay-at-home order. It's currently extended through the end of May, but I gather from your perspective, he would still have the authority to continue to do that if he felt
yes,
it was necessary.
Yes, but probably a modified order. Certainly things seem to be going a little better in Illinois. I suspect he's considering allowing a number of things. For instance, instead of saying no church services because and no graduations, you know, he's now beginning to rethink this. The real question is not whether there are 10 people in a church or 11 people. The question is how far apart are they? If they are 6 feet apart and they are in a huge cavernous church like the Episcopal Cathedral or the Catholic Cathedral here in Chicago, you can fit 50 people in quite easily and be very safe, especially if they're all wearing masks.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to ask about, you mentioned churches, and as you know, there was an Illinois church that filed a lawsuit last week in federal court over the extended stay-at-home order. This is in Lena. It's a rural community in the northwest part of the state, and they had been forced to close. A federal judge denied the order, but the church reportedly held a service Sunday anyway, and I wonder, what do you think about this distinction where churches, you know, previously at least were non-essential operations as compared to, say, liquor stores and marijuana businesses that were mm-hmm. deemed essential? What do you think about those distinctions?
Well, I think we made a terrible mistake by dividing us between essential and non-essential people. You, as a member of the press, are essential. I, as a law professor, am not essential. How do you think that makes me feel? And I understand how the churches feel here, because the real distinction, as I say, is whether they can be 6 feet apart and wash their hands, you know, use hand sanitizer, wear masks, and be 6 feet apart. That's the real distinction. As to the religious issue which this church is bringing up, they are wrong. Religion does not have that kind of a special role in the United States when it comes to public health.
I was going to ask about that because you know, you read the Constitution and it says, you know, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of religion. Why does the government have the power to say you need to stay away from your synagogue or church building or mosque or wherever it is?
Because it isn't so much you stay away from them, but you cannot gather there. They can do anything they want, as Judge Lee said in his opinion this morning about the church. You know, there is a saying, there is a phrase of Jesus in the book of Matthew, where two or three are gathered together in my name, lo, there am I in the midst of them. They can always meet. They can meet in some homes. They can meet in various places, but we're talking about 10 people together. And it's getting to be at, maybe 10 isn't the right number. As I say, maybe the issue is more 6 feet apart, but you cannot carve out something except for churches, because churches are still going to be spreading the disease. And the horrible thing is, if these people are all sitting next to each other in church pews, they're going to be dying.
And the last thing I want to ask you about is where you think, not just the church case, but particularly the two Republican state representatives who have sued to try and block the stay-at-home order in general, where do you think these cases are going to go?
They'll go to the Illinois Supreme Court, but probably within the next 2 weeks, there will be a certain loosening of the governor's executive order so that in some of the less populated areas of the state, like Clay County, where Representative Bailey comes from, maybe it isn't so necessary to have everybody talking about 10 people together. Maybe they're all already 6 feet apart from each other. I don't know. Here in Chicago, it's a very different situation.
Anne Lucene is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Illinois Chicago's John Marshall Law School. Professor Lucene, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure.
The city of Harrisburg in southern Illinois was considering defying the governor's extended stay-at-home order by allowing some businesses to open up, like hair and nail salons. But instead, the mayor there, John McPeak, and the city council advocated for a letter-writing campaign, encouraging residents to ask the governor to loosen restrictions instead of directly defying his order by a vote among city officials. It's just one example of a growing divide in some more rural areas of the state in recent weeks, where a handful of Republican legislators have called for a regional approach that would allow less populated areas of Illinois to open up with some restrictions. Governor Pritzker has said he's willing to consider that approach in the coming weeks. Kim Gibbs lives in Harrisburg, Illinois, and owns Man Cave Barbershop. She says her business has been struggling since the COVID-19 pandemic. She's here to tell us more. Kim, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, if you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 800-222-9455. Kim, could you tell us a bit about your barbershop?
Okay, my barbershop is located in Harrisburg. My barbershop was closed down due to the stay-at-home order. I closed down a day early because I was worried about the safety of my clients. Before I closed down my barbershop, I was taking all of the necessary precautions. I was taking temperatures at the door. I was asking all of the questions, you know, and doing the hand sanitizer, wearing a mask, making sure that all my clients were safe, and then I decided to close a day early.
And what made you decide to close before the governor actually sort of made it a requirement?
Well, whenever this all first came about, I was really worried about the safety of my clients. You know, kind of that panic came in, and I was watching the media and all of that, and it just seemed like it was a lot bigger than it actually has become.
So what have some of the challenges been for you as a business owner over the as this pandemic has developed over the last few months?
I have had to shut down my business completely. I have not got to see any clients at all, not even a one-on-one. I've lost all my income due to this. I applied for unemployment, and the Illinois unemployment office does not even have a site built for us yet, and it will not be built until the end of May is what I've been told, and for us to even apply to get those benefits. And then I've also applied for the PPP loan, and I did receive a little bit on that, although I have not been able to access it or use any of it because they don't have the state guidelines yet for sole proprietors to be able to pay themselves with that. So I've had zero income whatsoever, no stimulus check, nothing.
And just to be clear, nothing from the state government or the federal government to help you or your business since this shutdown has
happened? Not one thing at all. Yeah, nothing at all. And I am a single mother. I'm the only income for my family. And nothing that's been promised to us has been fulfilled whatsoever.
Now, I understand you shared the perspective of the mayor of Harrisburg, who actually owns a pizza shop in the area, that some places should be allowed to open up. Would you feel safe opening up?
I definitely would. We have had four cases in Saline County, which three of which have been recovered. And if 500 people can gather at Walmart, I don't see how one person cannot be in my shop at a time, wearing masks, wearing gloves, and sanitizing between each client. I'm not sure what the difference is there.
Yeah. All right. And so, I mean, I gather you would wear a mask, the client would wear a mask, you'd be doing whatever it takes to sort of comply with whatever rules there would be about sanitizing things?
Most definitely.
Yeah. And what do you hear from other people in your community? Are they following the stay-at-home orders?
People are everywhere. Walmart looks like Black Friday every single day.
Huh.
There are, I mean, it looks like spring break.
Wow. So people, I guess, seem to be getting I don't know if antsy is the right word, but, you know, not necessarily following the orders as much anymore. I guess if Walmart is the only place where they can go.
Oh, there's numerous places to go. It seems as if salons, barbershops, nail salons, and gyms are about the only thing affected in our town.
Hmm. All right. Kim Gibbs is the owner of Man Cave Barbershop in Harrisburg in the southern part of the state. Kim, thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us here on the 21st.
Thank you. Thank
you. And I'd also like to bring another voice into this conversation. Danielle Walls is the community health educator with the Ford County Public Health Department in Paxton in central Illinois. Danielle, welcome to the 21st.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
I wonder, how do you feel about this idea we've been hearing about a regional approach to opening up? Are you concerned even that smaller counties like yours could see a spike in cases?
Certainly, that is definitely a concern that we have. I want to first start out by saying that we definitely understand how incredibly challenging this time has been for everyone. This virus has impacted every single person in some form or another, and we definitely understand the eagerness that businesses that have had to close, we understand their eagerness in wanting to reopen. With that being said, being a public health department, obviously our main priority is the public safety, and we're concerned about keeping everyone healthy as much as possible. And so I do know that our administrator has been in discussion with our local state's attorney, as well as local law enforcement and other health officials, about the possibility of a regional approach to reopening some businesses. It's something that I know that we are open to, but again, the public safety is our biggest concern. Right now, we have a confirmed 9 cases in Ford County. Mm-hmm. 7 of those cases have recovered, thankfully. But what we want to make sure that everyone understands is while our cases have remained relatively low in Ford County, low risk does not mean no risk. And so while we would be open to a regional approach, we definitely want to make sure that if that is something that happens, that these businesses are taking the steps necessary to still ensure the safety of their employees as well as any customers or clients that they have.
And we've got just a little more than a minute left in our conversation, but we heard our previous guest talk about the Walmart looking like Black Friday every day in her part of the state. I wonder, what has the atmosphere been like among residents and businesses in Ford County?
As far as we are aware, everyone has really been doing their part in our area. Yes, there have certainly been times where stores have been busy, but we have more smaller businesses in our area, mm-hmm. And we know that our businesses have been doing really, really well, reaching out to us, making sure that they are up to date on the guidelines, and again, really just wanting to ensure the safety of the customers that are coming in and out of their stores.
And is the concern, what about healthcare workers? Is that a big concern that, they're potentially at risk here?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in our smaller areas with the rural hospitals that we have, that is definitely a concern, the safety of healthcare workers. We don't want our smaller hospitals to be overwhelmed. That obviously would not be a good thing. And so, again, the idea of reopening, while, again, we understand the eagerness of that, again, we have to make sure that we are taking all steps necessary to try to keep our cases lower and, again, ensure the safety of the public as well as healthcare workers. That's so important.
Danielle Walls is community health educator with the Ford County Public Health Department in Paxton in central Illinois. Danielle, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we're going to be turning to a new television miniseries, Mrs. America. It is somewhat about Illinois politics. That's just ahead on the 21st. Stay with us. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey.
I have to say, if you're in favor of this fraudulent amendment, I don't think you have any business calling yourself a Republican.
It's an innocuous piece of business. Have you read it?
Oh, yes, I have read it, Congressman. Have you read it?
Okay. Maybe an amendment is unnecessary. And yes, maybe we need to do something about that second clause. But sometimes we have to vote for laws that are symbolic so we can get the Dems to join us in passing more substantive items on our agenda, like tax reform.
Well, I hope your tax reform bill is worth writing off the 40 million homemakers for whom the ERA is not symbolic.
That's a clip from the new FX miniseries, Mrs. America. That was Cate Blanchett playing Phyllis Schlafly, the conservative activist from Alton, Illinois. The series begins in 1972 as the National Women's Political Caucus celebrates the U.S. Senate's passage of the ERA. At the same time, the savvy Schlafly is finding her political voice by rallying millions of women against the Equal Rights Amendment. More than four decades later and 4 years after her death, Phyllis Schlafly might not be a household name as it once was, but her legacy on both Illinois and national politics can still be felt. The first five episodes of the 9-part series are out on Hulu now, but in the meantime, I want to welcome two Illinois reporters who I hope can help us separate the historical facts from the TV fiction. Rachel Otwell is a reporter for Illinois Times in Springfield. We also have Ted McClellan with us. He writes for Chicago Magazine. They're both joining me via Zoom. Rachel, Ted, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Rachel, I mentioned it briefly, but can you give our audience some context about what was going on with the ERA when this series starts in 1972?
Yeah, there's a lot of setup in the first two episodes. And it actually begins in 1971, which is a year before the ERA was sent to the states for ratification after passage through Congress. And the first scene is Phyllis Schlafly modeling a bathing suit for a political fundraiser. She's introduced as the wife of one of our biggest donors, her husband, Fred, an attorney. And so the year before, she had lost a bid for a congressional seat. It had been her second race. And in the beginning of the episode, someone says, you know, it's impossible for a Republican woman to win downstate. And she says, oh, no, that was just because it's not because I was a woman. It's because of redistricting. So she's introduced as a woman who is seeking a more public life. And at one point, she says to her husband, don't forget to sign the charge card application, which is alluding to arguments by feminists at the time that the common housewife lacked autonomy and that the institution of marriage is a changing of hands of property from one male to another was still evident at this time. And so the episode also introduces us to feminists such as Gloria Steinem, who founded Ms. Magazine in 1971 and 1963, which they also allude to the feminine mystique and many see that book as ushering in modern women's liberation, that movement. And Friedan had questioned the meaning of life in the home and the disparities women faced when working outside of the home. Also going on, Shirley Chisholm's running as the first Black female candidate for president in 1972. Title IX had passed at this time, which was a law dealing with gender discrimination in education. And so we watched Schlafly's argument against the ERA evolve. Initially, she's dismissive, wanting to get involved politically in what she sees as more urgent, important matters like national defense. So it's this confluence of various political and social movements happening, and they're all swarming around the fact that the ERA, which had been drafted by suffragists in the 1920s, seemed like it was finally a sure bet. Proponents said it would heighten the legal standard in court, barring discrimination based on gender. It had hugely bipartisan support in Congress. Nixon was a fan, and so it seemed like in all inevitability, this thing was going to happen before Phyllis came along.
Mm-hmm. So Ted, that clip we heard in the introduction is from the first episode in the series. Schlafly is in Washington to lobby Senator Barry Goldwater against an arms treaty with the Soviet Union. And as the series depicts it, Schlafly was originally more interested in foreign affairs and national defense. But after she is demeaningly asked to take notes in the meeting, she comes back and commands the room by talking about the ERA. And people finally start to listen to her. Do we know how accurate that is as to how Schlafly got involved in the fight to stop the ERA, Ted?
Well, she had, she was a very prominent right-wing activist. She was involved in anti-communist causes. I think at one point she may have been a member of the John Birch Society, and she had written a campaign biography of Barry Goldwater called A Choice, Not an Echo, which was distributed to millions of people. I mean, from what I've read, she was not actually asked to take notes at that meeting. And some people have taken the show to be making the point that, she wasn't taken seriously as an arms expert, but, as a woman, this was an issue where, everybody had to listen to her, and that she could sort of ride to national prominence, which she certainly ended up doing.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. My guests today are Chicago Magazine writer Ted McClelland and Illinois Times reporter Rachel Otwell. We're talking about Phyllis Schlafly and the new FX miniseries about her, Mrs. America. And we have some tape of the real Phyllis Schlafly speaking with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
I had ignored the rising women's liberation movement. They were prancing around in the streets and burning their bras and things like that, which I ignored. I didn't think was important. Whereas I had spent now years researching and writing about the strategic balance. This woman, who was a friend and donor to my little organization, said, "I will send you a packet of materials, and I know which side you will be on." So she sent me the packet, and she was right.
Ted, once Schlafly decides to take on the ERA, what did she want, and how did she go about getting it?
Well, it's interesting that she was from Alton, and there was a point where she was originally from St. Louis, and there's a scene where she complains to her husband, "You drag me across the river," and he tells her, "Well, the view is better over here," and so it ended up being, the Stop ERA movement started in Illinois, and they worked very hard to stop it in Illinois. She gets a call from a supporter in Oklahoma who says, "We stopped it in Oklahoma." She says, "Well, okay, that's a conservative state. It might not be so easy in Illinois," but she went there. She worked with Henry Hyde, who was then the House Minority Leader and then later became a congressman. And he said, you need to bring your housewives. Look, all the women who are for the ERA are here in the galleries, and the representatives are going to look up and see them. So she not only bought the housewives, they baked bread and gave it to all the legislators. And they had the label on it, from the bread makers to the breadwinners. And in that interview you played at the Abraham Lincoln Library, she at another point she says, "Well, we knew the feminists couldn't do that because they couldn't bake homemade bread." And so Illinois ended up really becoming, I think, the key state in the whole ERA battle. And this went on for 10 years. And it failed. The problem, the advantage that they had in Illinois is a constitutional amendment requires a 3/5 majority, a supermajority. And the ERA sponsors, they had a majority, but they could never get over that hurdle. And there's a scene after they win the vote the first time. Her sister-in-law is reading the paper, and she says, "Well, you should thank Mayor Daley." And she said he had a quarrel with the sponsor, and he pulled 7 of his legislators away from it, which apparently is what actually happened, because one of the sponsors who's depicted in the show was a woman named Ginny Chapman. She was a Democrat from Arlington Heights, and she had supported Adlai Stevenson to be head of the Democratic delegation to the Democratic National Convention. And Daley was mad about that, and so he decided he was going to get back at her by sinking the ERA. I mean, and it probably wasn't a priority for him because he was a pretty conservative Catholic like Schlafly is. But I can't think of any. I don't know anything more Illinois or any better example of Illinois politics than Mayor Daley sinking the ERA over a personal grudge.
Yeah, that is pretty Illinois politics.
Yeah. So the show, I think the show is just, it just gets Illinois politics you know, almost perfectly.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that, but before we get to that, I want to go back to Rachel and talk a little bit about Schlafly as a person, because by 1972, she's no political novice. She's run for Congress. She's active in the Illinois political scene. She's balancing her duties as a woman and a wife versus her ambitions as a politician and I guess what we'd call today a change maker. And, you know, in the series, you can hear her. There's a scene where she brings muffins but stays to talk about a congressional run. So congressional redistricting. Rachel, there are so many moments where Schlafly experiences harassment and sexism in the series. Do you think that her ability to sort of inhabit dual roles, you know, appear as the traditional wife but also a clever politician, did that play in her favor or contribute to her success? Rachel?
There's no doubt that the kind of well-coiffed... can you hear me?
Yep, you're good. Yep.
Hello? Okay, sorry. Good old Zoom and technology. So the well-coiffed, elegant housewife persona was clearly part of her savvy political calculations, which is not to say that she wasn't all of those things, but it was what she chose to play up for the public. And she would thank her husband for allowing her to do debates, knowing how much that would irk the feminists. She was incredibly intelligent and prolific, authoring around 20 books. And all these newsletters that she was sending out and other writings, her daughter Anne Schlafly Corey told me, in response to the often heard criticism about her mom, that she played it off as though she was this housewife, but that she really was this political figure out in the public. She said her mother was active in the home. She took calls from the house phone. Her office was at the home. And by 1972, her six children were largely grown. Anne was still a child. But, you know, I know my own grandmother became involved in politics after her kids had grown as well. So this idea of being increasingly civically engaged as their duties at home were lessened is familiar. There's no doubt that she had help at the home and that she traveled extensively while campaigning. And obviously her daughter Anne is still actively engaged in politics. So I do think we lose some of the nuance in that there was still a level of acceptance within what these women stood for was so different. And they saw home life as a privilege, not a prison. I just want to say, like, I recently watched this address from 2007 where Mrs. Schlafly talks about doing the impossible. Defeating the R with people. It's possible, and media establishment. She credits her newsletter in activating tens of thousands of housewives who would go on to lobby with her, cook the bread, bake the bread like we talked about, have their own Stop ERA campaigns in their own states. And she talked about a 1976 rally in Springfield where more than 1,000 supporters came, including faith leaders who she had reached out to. And she said in getting people involved in politics who usually hadn't been, she and her supporters invented the pro-family movement, which was largely based on anti-reproductive rights, anti-LGBTQ rights, and gay marriage. And she said people of faith entered politics to protect families and the Constitution against the radical feminists, which were people she likened to be lesbian, socialists, and other unkempt persons. So she was very much activating not only housewives, but the religious right. Through these arguments and through her repeated message that she, like other housewives, were part of the most privileged class in America, getting to work from the home and be provided for by their husbands, and of course, not being subject to the draft. And yes, that definitely worked.
All right. Rachel Otwell is, and I'm afraid we have to leave it there. That is all the time we have for today. Rachel Otwell is a reporter with Illinois Times, and we've also spoken with Ted McClelland, who is a writer with Chicago Magazine. We're talking about the Phyllis Schlafly and the new FX miniseries about her, Mrs. America. Rachel and Ted, thanks so much for taking the time to be with me here today. Sorry we ran out of time.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Our show is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction for the programming and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. And today, we have to say goodbye to our intern, Eunice Alpison. Eunice has been with us since June, and in her time with the show, she's produced great segments, helped manage our web presence, and has dramatically increased our knowledge of pop culture. Thanks for everything, Eunice, and we can't wait to see what you'll do next. Please keep in touch. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening, and may the 4th be with you.